Okay, hello everybody. Brian Fitzgerald here, or Brian Poindexter. I think we're ready to commence this short event in Second Life, welcoming people from all over the world. We're here at QUT in Brisbane, Australia, and we've got people we know from California and from the east coast of the US. We've got people from the UK and other parts of Europe, and I'm sure there are others here as well. So the idea of today's discussion is to talk to the question that we have posed: 21st century creativity in a copyright world, how can the potential be realised? Which stems from a couple of recent events, particularly in Australia, that we've had to deal with, but really events that are happening all over the world, where different forms and ideas about creativity coming into conflict to some extent with existing laws and business methods for doing things. So what we wanted to do today was to ask a number of guest speakers that we have here. Richard Neville, a futurist who is now based in Australia but has been involved in cultural events all over the world. Mia Garlick, who's the General Counsel for Creative Commons, who's based in San Francisco. Mark Perry, who's a Professor of Law at the University of Western Ontario, who's joining us from Auckland, New Zealand. Dean Whitbread.
Sorry to interrupt you, Brian. We just want to check. A lot of people are saying they can't hear any audio. So before we continue, I'd just like to check out these technical difficulties.
Okay, Dean Whitbread, who is a blogger from the United Kingdom, Anne Matthew and Dylan Tamper-Pillay, myself, Brian Fitzgerald and Nick Suzor, who are all from the Queensland University of Technology here in Brisbane, Australia. So I think everyone's hearing us. I probably was just going a little bit fast on the introduction. I think I'll call forward Richard Neville, who is under a pseudonym Auntie, to come forward and say a few words. So, Richard?
Thanks very much, Brian. Look, excuse me for not coming forward because there's a there's a gentleman in a very colourful shirt obscuring my view of myself, so I'll just speak from a seated position, and my name online is Auntie Hazlitt for some obscure psychological reason that I don't fully understand. If anybody can hear, I hope everyone can hear me. If not, send me a text message. The Creative Commons, and welcome to that representative from Creative Commons. I think that's a fantastic idea. I use it a lot. Yes, I was just going to make the point that I think the Creative Commons is a fantastic idea. But it's not yet moving into the mainstream as quick as I think would be good for society. And I think that in the time we're having this conference is very apposite, because we've now entered a realm where creativity has actually replaced repetitive drudgery, slavery, and resource extraction as a kind of source of wealth. And even more importantly, maybe, as a source of potential survival for the people of this planet and the planet itself, because of the accelerating environmental decline. So creativity seems to be gaining kind of urgent importance every day. However, my second point is that because of the warp speed of acceleration, both in knowledge and information, it's becoming realized that the creativity is best nourished by working collectively, and I guess you all agree that, otherwise you wouldn't be here. And yet, creative collaborators more and more have to keep their ears cocked for fear of the war cry from anally retentive monopolizers and all their lawyers. And that war cry goes something along the lines of, hey, watch out, that's my intellectual property. And it's a terrifying war cry. It's almost like a terrorist act in a way, because it's often based on the flimsiest of grounds. And I don't particularly want it to start off on this personal way, but I've been asked to by Brian, is that I put a website up early in March, I think March the 13th, in which it was designed to look exactly like the website of the Australian Prime Minister, John Howard. It was called johnhowardpm.org, and a lot of the links on it were the same as the links on John Howard's own website. In other words, they had his normal everyday speeches. All I did was to concoct a speech in his tone, looking like it came from his website, but which reassessed his view of the Iraqi war. In other words, after, you know, in his platitudinous, clumsy style, he came to the view during the speech that actually it had been a huge disaster for Australia to be participating. And I posted this speech out to about 1,200 subscribers to my own website, just posted the link. And within about an hour, the Prime Minister's Department and the Federal Police were both on the phone pressuring the owner, the person that, at least Melbourne IT, which holds the domain name that I registered, in other words, johnhowardpm.org. So Melbourne IT were told immediately that I had kind of interrupted the intellectual property of the Prime Minister, which is a pretty bizarre concept anyway, and that thus it should be taken down. And Melbourne IT, after getting the phone call from the Prime Minister's office and also from Federal Police, panicked and just froze the domain name, put it on hold, which means the site, rather like the twinkling lights flicking off in Europe on the eve of the Second World War, the site disappeared. Now, I'm not talking about this out of a sort of personal pity, because I'm a person with a loud voice who has a lot of outlets, but the fact that that happened so quickly and without any reason, I think is something that raises questions as to the future of freedom of speech on the internet. Melbourne IT have since apologised. They'd realised that the original site was not an exact, was not endeavouring to imitate the entire ruling structure of the Prime Minister's office, that in fact it was a parody. Even more interestingly, the Australian Federal Police, the High Tech Crimes Unit, have issued a statement saying there was nothing criminal about the site, but still the site was closed. So I guess my point is that this is the act that's the digital equivalent of burning down a printing press, which of course would be considered outrageous, anti-democratic and so forth, and there'd be a huge complaint. But because it was on the web, it was deemed to be fairly trivial. Look, I think I'll stop there in case I'm not being heard and people might have questions.
Richard, thank you very much. What we might do is just get a few more of the speakers to speak, and then we might stop and take some questions.
That's fine by me.
Okay, so Mark Perry, are you there?
Yep, I'm here. I'll just move out so that people can see me.
Okay, how about you start, Mark, for about a few minutes talking to this topic.
I seem to have hit a script that sent me into outer space, but hopefully you can still hear my voice. Just let me know if you can, please, Nick.
We can hear you fine, Mark.
Go ahead, Mark.
Okay, so I just want to say something about the change that's going to happen in the next 20 years, whether we are prepared for it or not. And that's really the structure, the ontology and the paradigms that currently are behind our IP laws, how it's built up and why it's come about. This has all got to change. If you can imagine a pyramid with publishers at the top and distributors from halfway down and perhaps users at the bottom, the paradigm that's been built up over the last 400 years or so has been for creators to feed into the top there, so the publishers, and they have basically managed the distribution of hard based paper or artworks or whatever it is, solid objects distribution out to the rest of the world. And the whole economic system has been based on managing that kind of framework where you have this structure in place. And the money, bubbles up from the bottom, from the users up to the publishers quite nicely, and a little bit goes out to the creators on the side there. However, with the digital arena, we have a completely different paradigm that is possible, where you have creators feeding directly to users, you have more users becoming creators, and many of the publishing and distribution networks are cut out. So the pyramid shape is changing. It's not something that has to be there anymore. Consequently, or hopefully consequently, I think it's going to happen within 10, 20 years, we're going to have a different kind of IP regime in place that will support this new kind of structure. At the moment, in a transition stage, we're facing many edge issues where the people who currently hold the monopolies, publishers and so forth, are trying to maintain the old pyramid style by employing lobbying, bringing new legislation that helps maintain this kind of structure. But this is going to dissolve over the next 10 to 20 years, whether they like it or not. What we have to do, I think, as futurists and as lawyers looking to the future, is to think about what kind of legal structures we want to see in the future to build a new, more creative, digitally aware structure, framework, ontology. I'll try and fly back.
Okay. Okay, thanks, Mark. Dean, would you like to come in now and then maybe Mia? So, Dean, are you back?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Certainly can. Go ahead.
I'm not sure whether to say in a virtual environment, good evening, good morning, good day, good night. So I'll say all of them. I come from a position where I've been involved in online communities for a long time, and I've been doing things with intellectual property and copyright for 10 years on the internet. And I've recently become involved in Britain with the attempt to, influence and to a certain extent resist the imposition of what we see as rather clumsy licensing by the vested interests. In this case, I represent UK podcasters. There are about 250 UK podcasters, with probably another 5 or 10 turning up every week. And podcasting, as probably most of you know, is a fairly recent phenomenon, but a lot of it involves taking copyright material and making programmed episodic audio and making that available to the public. Now this has been fine for 2 years because A, it's a new technology which the vested interest, in this case the collection agencies in Britain, that's the MCPS, the Mechanical Copyright Protection Society, and the PRS, the Performing Rights Society. These two bodies, for those of you who don't know, are the people who are responsible for collecting royalties from television, radio, and obviously recently they've become very interested in online. Well, podcasting is quite different. It's something that they've never come across before, and they've been trying to formulate a response to it. And they decided at the beginning of the year to try to license podcasting, so they worked out that they were going to have a fairly low-level, approachable scale license for people who are podcasting, with £200 a year. I don't know what that is in your currency, but I'm sure you can work it out. But along with that, they decided to impose a lot of very clumsy and, as we saw it, unworkable podcast rules. And I'm just going to type into the chat. I'm going to type in a URL. I don't know if you can see that, but you should be able to see that. That's a URL. We decided to poll UK podcasters on the license, point by point. It was a very interesting license. They had lots of unworkable, rather unwieldy rules in there for us, which as we saw it would stifle creativity, were unworkable in many cases, and which really showed no real understanding of what podcasting was, how it was working. But we also realised that because podcasting is sort of a couple of years old now and people are beginning to make livings out of it, where there's money, there's always legislation, and we were going to be legislated, whether we liked it or not. And so we decided to form an association in the nature of a guild or a professional body, something which wasn't a union as such, or a sort of an industry body like an internet service providers association, nothing like that. But we realised that if we didn't collectivise and form a voice, which is very difficult when you're podcasting, because basically one of the reasons everybody does it is so they can have their own voice. But aside from that, we realised we needed to go to the licensing authorities and say, well, we represent UK podcasters, and please deal with us. And we're at the position now where we've just alerted them to our existence and heard the jaw drop. I actually had a phone yesterday to them, and it looks like we'll be able to meet with at least fairly high up members of the board, and hopefully be able to influence the further development of licensing. We're very keen that people that make commercial use of podcasting have a practical license to use the music that is licensed within their repertoire, but we're also very keen that they don't extend their mandate to, for example, voice-only podcasting. Now, if they did, that would mean I'd have to pay £200 a year to sit in front of my computer with my own microphone and record my own voice and then put it out in an episodic form for free to download for other people, which I think is probably infringing my human rights, and certainly I would absolutely reject it. How do we deal with these sorts of impositions? In this country, in the UK, we have a horrible history of our rights being eroded steadily and never really being replaced by anything. And the European court is very slow to act and very ponderous and doesn't really protect us. Actually, we think that there's no real... although we do argue the case for the Creative Commons license, we sat in with the BBC 2 weeks ago, and we were very keen, and they were keen to use Creative Commons and to use that as a method by which people can submit content to the BBC, which is a public broadcast service organisation after all, and define their own levels of protection as they saw it. But that won't help us here, because basically where there's money, there will be legislation, and we're just trying to, as I say, we're trying to make sure that we can influence the development of licensing and be in there from the ground, make sure that these people don't actually put us out of business or just prevent some kid coming along and deciding he wants to use, I don't know, a Rolling Stones track for 10 seconds in his podcast. And we could also see, I mean, the writing was on the wall. We didn't want to go the same way here as America, which is very litigious, and end up with 12-year-old podcasters being sued for using some very brief snatches of copyright music. The other thing that's happened here is that there's a huge increase in interest in using what they call pod-safe music. In other words, this is music which hasn't been licensed through the major collecting agencies, and which the artists are perfectly free, therefore, to license for the use of podcasts. I don't know if you know Magnatune, but Magnatune make a policy of licensing all of their repertoire of that particular record label for podcast use, because they see that all that will happen is that the more people that podcast their work, the more exposure their artists get, the more creativity will leak out, and that this is a good thing. And actually, the Magnatune philosophy is my philosophy. I tend to go along with that. I think that artists want exposure. Really, they should be really happy and pleased and grateful that they've got enthusiastic podcasts playing their tracks to new audiences. And actually, the more enlightened musical artists, I've just talked about music mainly, but that is most of podcasting, that is the controversial area of podcasting in any case. Some of the enlightened artists like David Bowie and Prince, of course, have gone on record as saying that they're very happy that people file share even. But we can see that the licensing authorities are using file sharing, which is the real bugbear, and conflating podcasting with file sharing, and this is what worries us, that they are going to equate somebody who has 50 downloads a day from a small podcast where they play a copyright track, and they're going to perhaps claim that we're the same as the file share, the evil file sharers, and we're running multiple servers full of MP3s for profit, which of course we're not. I think I've spoken for about 5 minutes. Thanks very much for listening. I'm going to put up something on Funk, which is just for this conference, which is the brand new, received yesterday, MCPS PRS podcasting license, and I shall just type that into the chat box. But it's funk.co.uk/QUT, and there's also a couple of articles from Broadcast Magazine and Campaign Magazine on podcasting in that directory. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Dean. Can you hear me? Yeah. The reason why we chose today to do this is because today, at least at this time in Australia, the 26th of April, is actually World Intellectual Property Day. And we're certainly not advocates for the abolition of intellectual property, but we're certainly very keen to see that intellectual property laws, particularly copyright law, is able to work for all types of people in all different ways. One of the things that I've just come back from was a conference at Yale on access to knowledge and the draft Access to Knowledge Treaty, and I also attended the Fordham International IP Conference, which is run each year in New York. It was interesting to hear Professor Terry Fisher from Harvard Law School talking at the Fordham conference about the need to have in our laws, particularly in the fair dealing, fair use area, a better understanding of non-commercial, highly transformative, non-substitutable, derivative works. That may be where someone has done a remix or a mashup and they're not out to gain money for their efforts, nor are they necessarily going to undermine the market in the original product. And the law in most countries has quite a bit of difficulty in dealing with that. One of the projects that certainly has breathed a lot of life back into this area is the Creative Commons project, which works on the basis of copyright but requires people to act in a voluntary manner if they want to share their material. So I might hand over to Mia Garlick and ask her to make a few comments. So over to you, Mia.
Great. Hi, everyone. I hope the voice is working okay. So I wanted to just talk to the topic about the, you know, the potential and how we try to realise the creativity. I guess I'm happy, of course, to talk about Creative Commons because that's what I do every day. So I'm happy to answer questions about that later. But I thought that this being World Intellectual Property Day, perhaps it might be useful to sort of look at the meta picture or the bigger picture about what we can do to kind of enable the or maintain the amazing creativity that the internet and digital technologies have allowed. I mean, obviously at the moment, user-generated content is a huge buzzword, and I was at an event recently where there were advertising executives coming along to a Creative Commons event because they knew there was this thing called user-generated content and they knew they had to get involved with it, but they didn't quite know how. So I think that's a tremendous result when you have people... Oh, speak up a bit. Okay, sorry, one sec. Great. So obviously, you know, advertising people, etc., everybody knows that they've got to pay attention to it. And, you know, we have 50 million Creative Commons licensed objects out there in the online space, and we have key organisations in education and the creative industries experimenting with Creative Commons licensing and other flexible content licenses like the BBC Creative Archive Project, and obviously that's fantastic, but the challenge, I guess, for us right now is this the start of a trend, or is this just a minor bump along the way to a passive lockdown culture? So I wanted to just sort of suggest a couple of ways in which we can possibly try to ensure that this is actually the start of a trend and not a bump in the road. So I guess the first thing is obviously individual action. For all of us who create material or who use material is to really try to engage with either applying, you know, sort of flexible licenses like Creative Commons licenses or using and enjoying freely licensed content, whether it's in your blog or in podcasts or the Christmas gifts that you give to your friends and family. I think that's sort of one way to kind of prove that the Commons is active and alive. And obviously staying up with debates and being engaged in the issues as they come about is an important part of it as well. There's also probably a level at which if you're a member of an established content representative or you're a representative for an organisation, and here I'm thinking particularly of collecting societies, that if you're a member of a collecting society, to actually try to engage with them to encourage them to be open to Creative Commons licensing, which currently is most collecting society members are conflicted out of, and that's sort of another element of individual action that I think is going to be very important to seeing the success of kind of a free and open culture. Then I guess there's also policy debates. Traditionally, IP laws have been developed and adapted based on this sort of binary philosophy that more protection equals more creativity and more protection equals good. And I think that it's becoming increasingly evident that more protection is not necessarily conducive to more creativity and can come at a very high cost of public access. And certainly the experience of Creative Commons licensing is sort of showing an empirical evidence that more protection is not necessarily in keeping with all copyright owners' interests, and that more protection may not necessarily be good. And so I think that's an important thing for people to be pointing to and relying on in policy debates. And finally, I just wanted to end by saying there have been sort of various criticisms of the creativity that digital technologies enable. Some people in established artistic and literary circles feel that Flickr and digital cameras are sort of the beginning of the end of serious culture, and they degrade the meaning of creativity. And I think that there is a level at which if all of us can take photos and share our material, that maybe some of it isn't all fantastic, although I do think that there's some fairly elitist attitudes going on in some of those cultural circles. And so I also hope that one of the trends that we're going to see to kind of maintain a vibrant commons that we can point to and be proud in these policy debates is the development of communities that can select and identify and support and encourage exemplary examples of great commons content. So that's all I was going to say today, unless people have questions later on.
Okay, thanks, Mia. We might just take one or two more people and then allow some open questions and so on. But the other thing that I should mention was that the ARC Centre of Excellence for Creative Industries and Innovation were the people here at QUT who encouraged us to participate in World IP Day, and we thought this would be a good way of doing that. Now, Chris Shannon, you're out there somewhere. You might just want to identify yourself. I'm not sure which pseudonym you're under. If you want to identify yourself, you don't have to. That's okay. Anyway, Chris, thanks for your help, and we'll keep moving. And next up, we'd like Toby Miller, who's a professor at University of California, Riverside, and is well known for his work on global Hollywood, to join us. And Toby is going to type in because we've had some difficulties in setting him up with his mic. So Toby, over to you, if you can. Okay, thanks very much, Toby. And one of the other interesting things that you've been talking to us about when you've been here is also the idea of different product placement and different corporations having products in music and film, obviously. I'm not sure if you want to make any comments about that now or you want to do so later, but you've certainly also made some interesting arguments and points in that area as well. I can see you typing, so I'll wait for you. Okay, thanks. I think there's some really interesting points as well. So we'll keep moving on. Thanks very much, Toby, and I've just realised that you're actually operating from the same computer as Chris Shannon, so Christabel is Toby and Chris, so thank you. We might take a few questions. We've still got at least three, who will talk to us. Axel Bruns, Anne Matthew and Dylan Tampa-Pillay, and Nick Suzor will round off. Does anyone want to make any comments? Richard Neville, would you like to make any particular comments about anything you've heard so far?
Well, yes, I think it was Dean that used the phrase infringement of human rights. So, again, I think we must balance our sort of concern with the legal niceties and implications, which are important, with the bigger picture, especially as freedom of speech is much more under threat now than it was even 2 or 3 years ago, certainly in Britain, the US and Australia. And the fact, just one point I wanted to make about that, the beast of intellectual property, which of course we understand that it's only ethical that the major creator should have some benefit from his or her work, but when this beast becomes untamed and ill-defined, it can be used to clamp down freedom of speech, which is why I want to bring it back to this idea of satire and parody. And you know, because mainstream media really is pretty compliant with government obsession with terrorism and limitations of freedom of speech, it's actually up to the outsiders, the satirists and the people who are very good at puncturing authority. And the techniques they use often involve them imitating other people's kind of persona and stance, and in a way their intellectual property, but it is not stealing from them. So I'd also like people not to consider not getting too technical about this matter, and really, perhaps to put it melodramatically, you realize that perhaps we are suing, this is a battle in a way between freedom of speech ultimately and the ever enlarging beast of intellectual copyright.
Richard, could I just ask you a question? You don't have to answer, obviously, if you don't want to. But you know, in the 60s, you know, we've all read and heard about you know, the publication of Oz and the trial that ensued after that. And I suppose a lot of people think of that as a difficult era for people wanting to express things. I mean, do you draw any parallels from those experiences and the things that are happening now with some of the, I suppose, copyright and sort of security issues that seem to be being raised in terms of creative and activity?
Well, Brian, yes, this will sound a bit pompous, but I think that some eras are defined by their incredible creativity, and they're the ones that really are remembered long after dead periods have gone. And I think you could put the ancient Greece of Socrates in that, you could put Elizabethan England in that category, and obviously the Renaissance, and the creativity in those eras is actually built through a very easy, free-flowing collaboration rather than this obsessive idea of the artist in isolation. And you know, half of Leonardo's paintings, no one quite knows who painted them or how many people. Now the 60s did have, especially during the early protest era, a sense that we were sharing ideas for the greater good. And I know that sounds really woozy, but I mean, there was Mick Jagger wrote Street Fighting Man, and you know, sent the lyrics off to an underground newspaper called, I think it was called Black Dwarf, which published it. And with there was no kind of, not even the Rolling Stones, who were kind of famously mean, were interested in copyright issues back then. Now, I think that really helped to give juice to a period. Of course, as we started becoming successful, especially in terms of provoking discontent with the Vietnam War, then authorities clamped down. And again, one of the ways they tried to do it was to silence critical magazines. So I think there are some parallels. I think the 9 out of 10 of the major stories of the last, well, let's say since the invasion of Iraq, have really actually been broken on the web first. And then the star reporters come in and sort of follow the trail and get into more legitimate journals. But because of that, the web is becoming increasingly monitored, everything can be read and extracted, sites can be closed down, and it's an increasing case of over-policing. But often the battering ram is intellectual property. When it doesn't actually involve intellectual property, it involves honourable dissent.
Yeah, some very useful comments, and I think the critical thing is that if government is going to act on the basis of copyright or intellectual property rights, that it would be good to have that process being transparent and according to the rule of law. So I think those things are incredibly important too. What we might do is, we've still got a couple of people that we've asked to come along and speak, and we'd like them to speak, but we'd like to now open it to everybody, anyone who wants to ask a question perhaps, and we might spend 5 minutes or so just on some questions, and if not, we'll continue on. Okay, everyone's stage fright for the moment. Let's just keep going then, and we'll come back at the end and spend a bit of time discussing issues. So, Axel Brooms, are you there? I think you're someone's nerd, is that right?
I am indeed, yes.
So, Axel,
can you hear me?
I can hear you, and yes, just to introduce Axel Brooms, who's also an academic at Queensland University of Technology in Brisbane, Australia, in the Creative Industries faculty, is very interested in the area of blogs, and last year published a very influential book called Gate Watchers, on the new form of journalism, or new ideas about journalism in terms of blogging. So I'm going to hand over to Axel.
Okay, thanks very much, Brian, and hello everyone. I'm here under the name of Snurb Clinton for obvious reasons. I'm sitting somewhere next to the red marker on the stage, so you'll find me there. I'm probably going to follow on a little bit from what Mark Perry said in his contribution, and I want to take something of a big picture angle here. A good deal of my research in the past few years really has been particularly on the collaborative publishing of alternative online news, as Brian has said, and more widely in blogging overall, as well as the increasing use of wikis for collaborative knowledge management and content creation. So what I'd like to do is to suggest that such cases of widely distributed collaborative content production, which is often led by users themselves, are really all part of a wider trend that has its roots in part in the academic model of peer review and peer criticism, in artistic collaboration, and more recently probably also in some of the frameworks developed for open source software development. Now there have been already a number of us describe this, and people like Charles Ledbetter have talked about pro-am content development. There was Alvin Toffler's idea of the prosumer. Jochai Benkler more recently has called it commons-based peer production, and I think all of these kind of describe something very similar. But I'm actually quite keen to get away from this idea of terms of professional production and consumption, because I think that they all still really hark back to traditional producer-consumer dichotomies that now have been thoroughly undermined in recent years. So I think production and usage are now really increasingly two sides of the same coin, and we produce new content in the very process of using what's already out there. So I've started to call this phenomenon producage, or this type. That's just my term, which I find useful. And of course, this is not necessarily new either, of course. But the industrial age, I think, had imposed an artificial distinction between producers and consumers that is now vanishing, is now evaporating. And so terms like producers, I think, are useful and are necessary. So what persists there at the same time, and I say this very much as someone who isn't a legal expert, of course, but I think what persists are intellectual property frameworks which are built on that separation of producers and consumers from the industrial age. They regulate the production and the consumption of IP, when I think it's becoming increasingly necessary instead to develop protocols for the producage of IP, that use and production at the same time of IP. So having said that, I want to just point out that in my view at least, producer has four fundamental characteristics, and I think a new framework for IP that takes into account producage needs to deal with these four characteristics. And just very briefly, when first off, producer is inherently collaborative, of course. If usage becomes productive, then this is necessarily a collaboration between previous and current users and producers, or for short, producers as I call them, and amongst multiple producers contributing at the same time. But it's not necessarily a collaboration which has been explicitly sanctioned by the holders of existing IP, of course. Second, producer is often led by users, or at least involves them very closely and very directly. And the process there is often one of trial and error. And some compare that very much to evolutionary processes as well. Now this creates, I think, another problem, as the outcomes of producage aren't necessarily known beforehand. And so it's another, it's difficult to use traditional IP licensing processes, I guess, to grant the rights to use existing content if what the final outcome will be is still unknown. Third, and perhaps most problematically, producage is palimpsestic. It builds on what's already there and it alters and overrides that. The Wikipedia is perhaps one of the most obvious examples of that, of course, but there are, of course, many more. I think that, again, creates even bigger problems for traditional IP frameworks. Not only is it difficult to foresee the final outcomes of the process, but on the one hand, there are no final outcomes, as the process is an ongoing one. And on the other, whatever temporary outcomes are produced involve a complex process of collaborative authorship, which can literally lead to artifacts where individual participants contributed really only one word here or there. So, in theory, the Wikipedia, for example, could certainly track which contributors added what bits of content, but in practice, to do so, and indeed to track licensing permissions or distributing royalties for individual users, would be an absolute nightmare, of course. And that then leads me to the fourth and final point there. Many such producer environments already are employing a variety of alternatives to standard copyright licensing, of course, whether that's in the form of open source licenses, the GPL that's used by the Wikipedia, Creative Commons licenses, and that's all, I think, well and good, but I'm really not sure even that can be the end point of the development. Alternative licenses are great for alleviating the increasingly restrictive frameworks which the major players in the content industries have been able to get inscribed into copyright law, of course, but they don't challenge the fundamental assumption that intellectual property is about the rights of producers and consumers as two very distinct groups. So instead, I think what's needed is, at a more fundamental level, the development of intellectual property regimes that move away from that dichotomy. We need intellectual property regimes that are built around the idea of producage, or whatever we end up calling it, rather than production and consumption. That then, I think, will recognize that the development of IP is now, in fact, perhaps has always been widely distributed, sometimes ad hoc, and perennially unfinished process that involves users and producers, or in short, producers of intellectual property collaborating with one another. Now, just how that's to be done is another question, of course, but because I'm not a legal expert, I'll just leave that to our friends of the legal persuasion, I think. Thanks very much, guys.
Okay, thank you very much, Axel. That's very interesting, and I think it links in with a number of things, that that people are looking at how the copyright law, particularly of the future, will look. I know John Hawkins from the United Kingdom, who wrote the Creative Economy book, is starting up a project called 2010 Copyright, which is going to, I think, mark the anniversary of the 1709 copyright statute from the United Kingdom, the Statute of Anne, and also propose ideas for the future. And one of the things, I think, a couple of things that come up in that process are that, one, the copyright laws of the future have to better understand collaborative and open production and consumption models, and also, secondly, that the idea of distribution being a critical thing now in terms of our social, economic and cultural development, that copyright law needs to also map back from the idea of distribution rather than just forwards from the idea of creation and production. And in doing that, we may see things slightly differently. So that leads me to the next person I'd like to introduce, who is Anne Matthew from QUT Law School, who's been doing a lot recently on looking at the recent Kazaa case that was litigated in the Australian courts. So, Anne?
Thank you, Brian. Yes, I've been looking at these authorisation cases. Authorisation is a pretty interesting copyright law doctrine because I think it can really play a role in the future development of IP law. Right now, these doctrines are no doubt quite confusing and vague in their scope, but they really could open up scope for innovation in future. So I guess what I'd like to look at is really just how they could be used to open up the scope for innovation, because what the law is presently doing is entrenching the power of copyright owners and acting as a barrier to entry for new innovation. But if we could encourage the judiciary to take a fairly narrow view as to what constitutes authorisation, then it might be possible for the law as already enacted to provide some better scope for creating an environment which allows innovation while still affording protection to copyright owners. But if they continue to take a wide view as to what constitutes authorisation, then we're capturing a wider variety of innovative behaviour and businesses that enable innovative technology. So legislative reform that gives innovators some breathing room might be required. The two cases that have most recently come before the courts are Sharman in Australia and Grokster. These are both cases where the copyright owners have been, you know, powerful economic players from the movie and entertainment industries and music industries, and the targets of the litigation really haven't been equally powerful heavyweights. Rather, they've gone for targets that have been capable of allegedly inflicting enormous economic harm without being economically strong outfits themselves. So none of the litigation has resulted in a financial windfall for the plaintiffs. The result has simply been to reinforce their copyrights and to reinforce their power as to negotiate to the future terms of its use. Typically the litigation settles, that was certainly the case in Grokster, and the individual businesses sued have usually closed down or gone under, but the technology hasn't. It's simply gone underground and it's just re-emerged in a slightly altered form, and there's little doubt that that's just not in favour of a strong innovative future, because the technology is simply mutating in response to the parameters that have been set by the latest judicial determination. And that's clearly a responsive cycle. The law's just simply playing catch-up with infringing innovations, which is fairly futile, because the technology at the heart of the disputes is simply developing and mutating faster than the matter can be dealt with, which is certainly the case in Sharman. By the time Sharman's finally determined, the technology might well be prehistoric, so the copyright owners will be left with a new nemesis to face. Thanks, Brian.
Okay, Anne, thank you very much. And just finally, our last speaker is Dylan Temper-Pillay. Dylan, are you there and are you ready to go?
Yeah, Brian, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. So Dylan is from our QUT Law School as well. He's recently joined us from the Australian Attorney General's Department, where he was working on IP-related issues.
Thanks, Brian. I just want to make a couple of quick comments and possibly some slightly overly legalistic ones. I think that what's happening now in the digital era is a number of new cultural practices such as mashups, digital sampling, fan fiction, megamixes and remixes, and these things by secondary creators using a substantial part of the works of primary creators need to be encouraged, in part because provided that they don't undermine the commercial basis of the primary creators, they exemplify the human right to express, to interact with culture and to communicate with others, which are things which our society should respect and encourage. But the problem for us, I think, is threefold, particularly in Australia. And the first one is that the political will doesn't necessarily exist in terms of really making substantive amendments to the Copyright Act. The second problem is that in the terms of the Copyright Act itself, if you look at our fair dealing laws, they're actually quite inadequate. And if you take a more recent, well, one of the more recent fair dealing cases, which was the case of Channel 9 versus Channel 10, the panel case, in that case, the federal court conflated the elements for fair dealing with each other to such an extent that the panel case in terms of fair dealing has very little precedent value. The other problem with our fair dealing provisions is that they are very, very heavily reliant for their interpretation on a very disparate and sometimes conflicting collection of case law. Take, for example, Richard Neville's a paper involving John Howard's speech. Now, I'm not for a moment saying that that was copyright infringement, but for argument's sake, if there was some copyright infringed, we would be thrown back on the fair dealing provisions, most likely Sections 41, criticism and review. The problem, but, is that under Section 41, it would not necessarily have been clear if it was, in fact, a fair dealing. The third problem is our international obligations, particularly with respect to the Berne Convention. And taking the Berne Convention and its test for laws in relation to limitations, particularly the three-step test, and then placing that in a trade context, as such as the Australia-United States Free Trade Agreement and the TRIPS Agreement, adds a level of enforceability to the Berne Convention, such that even if we actually do think that some of these emerging cultural practices are worth protecting, we're heavily constrained in our ability to actually come up with new laws to give effect to those practices. And if we do try and do so, we might face trade sanctions. Of course, that would depend on the scope of the practices and the exceptions we create. But the upshot is that we are very, very constrained in what we can actually do. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Dylan. Everybody, I think, Nick, you're the only person who hasn't spoken, and if it wasn't for Nick and Mark Perry, who I think we've lost in New Zealand because he's a couple of hours in front of us, and he's got some problem with room over there. If it wasn't for Mark Perry and Nick, we wouldn't have got anywhere today, and they've done an enormous job in making this possible. So Nick, how about a few concluding comments, and then maybe any comments from anyone in the audience or any of the other speakers?
Well, just before we continue, I'd just like to note the amazing possibilities offered by virtual worlds like Second Life, the technology that allows us to have this discussion from various places all around the world, and the intellectual property questions that this does raise, production in this world which is mostly creative and crosses economic and national boundaries. It's going to raise some very interesting questions in the future, which we don't have time to discuss today, but hopefully we'll be able to do more of these meetings and get a bit more in-depth. So, if I can have any questions from the audience, or Dick, do you want to continue?
I'd just like to come back on what you were saying then about fair dealing. It's a lot of activity at the moment works in that slightly grey area of the copyright definition, and I don't know if you guys know about this, but the UK government is currently reviewing fair dealing. It's copyright, in fact it's reviewing the entire copyright law, but it's supposed that it won't do very much about it, it's just going to look at the law. But the issue that's under most scrutiny is that exactly that of fair dealing. To a certain extent, I've been relying on fair dealing in order to incorporate copyright works in our own content. The other thing I've been doing is using copyright content, but the structure within which I'm using it is applying a different license. So I'm using a Creative Commons license for that, and I'm doing that for a very deliberate way, which is, I'm showing two things. I'm showing that there are layers of interoperability here between the traditional copyright model and the new ones that are evolving. And on the other hand, I'm quite deliberately trying to confuse the licensing authorities because they don't quite understand how we're doing what we're doing. And I'm happy with that very much. Because the more that they're confused, the more they have to think outside their box. And after all, this can only be a good thing for creative people, and obviously I count myself in that.
Yes. Okay. Thanks, Dean. Anyone like to comment on that? Or Teflon? I haven't heard anything from you. I'm just wondering if you're going to make a comment.
The question asked from Mia was, what is the most powerful way we can resist the passive lockdown culture? from Teflon.
Hi, I'm going to try to answer that by speaking. So I guess I think there are a couple of ways. I mean, obviously, if you engage with and demand sort of freely licensed culture and experiment with it, I mean, I think business at the moment people sort of can see that there is this sort of freely licensed content out there, but a lot of people are sort of dismissing it either because it's not good quality in their view, or because they don't think it's going to make anyone any money. And so I think, you know, if you've got examples of, you know, Magnatune, which has already been mentioned, and various other net labels that are, you know, trying to experiment with making content available, but then also making it available for sale. We've had various people, you know, putting books online under a CC license and then selling hard copies. I mean, I think if we start to show that there's good stuff out there and there's ways that people can make money and we can reward creativity, then people will start to take sort of participatory culture more seriously. And I think the other thing, obviously, the big thing hanging over our heads is digital rights management. Until someone can actually create a system that enables fair use and fair dealing and CC licensed content, then I think that we have to be very careful about any kinds of DRM systems and try to resist them as much as possible. But I welcome any other comments anyone else had, any of the other speakers or anyone in the audience.
Okay, so thanks, Mia. Richard, what about you? Any feedback on that?
Yeah, look, I've been a bit distracted because there's real life always going on around one. I love that question about how to resist the, what was it, the passive choking kind of monopolistic culture. I know that's not quite accurate, but I mean that's really at the bottom line of what this conversation is about, is to actually not so much fight a campaign of retreat, little skirmishes, but to actually be, I think, a little bit more head-on in confronting excessive use of copyright or completely bogus arguments about why, you know, something should be restricted instead of actually expanded, because we are building the future on the shoulders and the brains of other creative ideas, but we're also building it collectively, and the future itself has changed because it's something that can no longer be taken for granted. It needs to be rescued. Probably not everyone here will agree with that, but there is a sense of urgency about moulding human society to be as creative as possible and as innovative as possible in solving some of the problems. So at its core, this battle between freedom to think and be creative and to share ideas, and as against enriching, you know, people that have held copyrights and brands for hundreds of years, is a very serious one. And I think it's we shouldn't think of it as a footnote or a side issue or as a skirmish. This is of major import.
There was an interesting example in Australia not so long back where someone remixed the Green Day album American Idiot and went under the name Dean Gray and called the remix American Edit. And within a very short time of them having put the remix version on the web, they received a letter which said they should take it down or they'd be sued for copyright infringement. And there's no doubt that the people that were asserting copyright were on fairly strong grounds in terms of saying they had ownership of particular copyright material. But the difficulty in that situation was that the people who were engaging that remix activity, which no doubt had a lot of creativity and interest, and could well have led to you know, untold creativity across the world, were not able to leave their material up there because they were fearful of being sued. So it's those kind of issues. And Damien O'Brien and myself, a researcher here at QUT, recently wrote an article about remix and the Australian copyright law, and it's very difficult for people to engage in a lot of these activities within the current boundaries of copyright law, both here in Australia and really in many other countries throughout the world.
Can I just make a very small point at the risk of being a bore? Is strange thing that's happening with mass media is that when there's a particular episode or just even an event in mass media on any subject really, cultural or musical, it's very quickly, it's sort of re-edited and just into a 3-minute clip and just sent all over the place. And it could be an amazing speech, let's say, from Boston Legal. And I'm just wondering, does anyone in the audience, if they come across these, they're often quite political and they're extracted from the mainstream, but they're sort of repackaged and focused. What are the copyright issues of that, and what, and I mean, it's, in my opinion, it's not really stoppable, because by the time anyone wants to take action, a million computers have already seen the material.
Okay, thanks, Richard. We're going to have to finish up very soon, because lots of people are in lots of different places, and some of you are no doubt getting very tired. I know I'm a little jet-lagged, having just come back from the US. But has anyone got any further questions or comments they'd like to make? Do you want to make a comment, Deke, through the audio?
I can do.
Sorry, you just typed something in there about commercial and the piracy situation.
Yeah, I think that the legislators, I think that we need to take arguments to them. I really am following up on the concept of passivity, and I mean, there is a huge difference between people who, for example, download a Hollywood movie and stick it on BitTorrent and share it with thousands of people, and there is a strong argument to be made that whether you approve of the Hollywood system or not, or like the film, there's a strong argument to be made that that this is depriving people of their income. And what frustrates me is that this sort of activity gets conflated with a blogger quoting somebody and making a comment, or a podcaster using in a very non-commercial way. Let's face it, the tiny amounts of income we're talking from these new media, although it's exploding, I mean, there's very, very little in the way of commercial activity here. And this is what frustrates me. I think that the legislators and authorities as we have them now tend to be, and also I'm talking about the commercial authority, the people who are used to wading in and shutting down people who have their copyright. These people really it needs to be pointed out to them in a sense, look, there's no money coming from this, this is a very different thing.
Okay, yep, some good points. Okay, so anything other than that last comment from Dean? Okay, looks like we're just about to finish up. I'd like to thank everyone for coming along and participating. Particularly, I'd like to thank the speakers and obviously the people who have stayed up after hours to participate, and people who've woken up very early to participate, such as Dean. So thank you very much to everyone from QUT Law Faculty, our Intellectual Property Knowledge, Culture and Economy Research Program, and from the Creative Industries Centre for Creative Innovation and Creative Industries. We'd like to say goodbye and thank you, and particularly Richard, you're signing off, Mia is signing off. Thanks once again to everyone for participating. Goodbye. Thank you.